When I talked to flutist Emmanuel Davis recently, one of the first things he told me that caught me by surprise is the fact that he doesn't speak French, but he loves playing French music. And that's exactly what he's doing on his new recording, La Magnifique. It celebrates flute music for the court of Louis XIV, and he's joined by his friend, colleague, and mentor, Bartold Kaikin. It's music for Baroque flute, and that's what we're going to be hearing about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Emmanuel, let's start off by just kind of discovering you. How did the flute become your way of life?
The flute became my way of life. It's always a little funny to tell this story. It became a little bit by accident, which was that in fifth grade, I wanted to play the saxophone. And growing up in most schools, kids of my age, in fifth grade, it was time to choose your instrument before you got into band. And I wanted to play the saxophone. And my mother had this idea that I should play the flute. She just thought, I think you'd make a good flute player. She thought I would enjoy it. And I got a flute, so I chose flute in fifth grade, and it took me about a month to get a sound out of it, but I stuck with it. Because it's not like a trumpet that you put up to your lips or a clarinet that you can put in your mouth or a piano that you can just touch. It's like you have to figure out how to, put your lips together and blow across this thing that you can't feel. So it took me a long time to get the sound out. But then once I did, it just became something I wanted to do more and more.
Did your mom ever say why she thought you'd be good at playing the flute?
No, it was just like an inkling that she had. Just something about it.
Mother's intuition.
Exactly. And flute, when I was growing up, if you were into music in the late 1970s, it was all about Jean-Pierre Rampal, James Galway. Those guys were just huge. I actually grew up in a musical household, but even in non-musical households, those names were just, everywhere. So it's funny when I go back home and I see like our old record collection from when I was a kid, and there are like all of these Rampal records in there that I don't remember buying, but we just had them. So I just grew up listening to him in particular.
Any Jethro Tull in there, or?
Of course, yes. Everybody, Jethro Tull, the jazz flute players like Hubert Laws, people like that, I grew up listening to. Yes, absolutely. I was a total flute, still am total flute. I don't know what the word is. Well, junkie or something like that.
Well, you are equally comfortable playing modern and Baroque flutes. Can you tell us what the difference is between those instruments?
Well, it's taken me a long time to get comfortable at doing both. I'm a Juilliard-trained regular modern flute player, and I always had heard Baroque flute. Actually, my high school flute teacher was this woman named Sandra Miller in New York City. And she now teaches at the Juilliard Historical Performance Program. And she played Baroque flute. She was also a modern flute player, and she was my modern flute teacher. But I used to hear her play Baroque flute, so that sound sort of got into my ear when I was a kid. But then when I was at Juilliard, I was studying with the great Julius Baker, and it was, you got to prepare your stuff for him every week. And there was no time when I was a student to think about dividing my practice time into doing Baroque flute and modern flute. And then after I graduated Juilliard and I actually got this job about the same time of coming to study, teach at the University of Minnesota, I was thinking I wanted to delve in more to studying the Baroque flute. And the two instruments are they have similarities that, the way you blow across the instrument is similar. A lot of the fingerings are similar, but then they do divide and they become very different. Like a modern flute is a lot about singing. Just like emotionally, you're singing the music. It's about very long lines. It's about equality. Modern flute players, we have all of these exercises that we do that about making every note on the flute equal. That is something that we really love. Everything today is about equality in music making. And the Baroque flute and Baroque music, when you really get into it, it throws that away. That's the first thing you have to learn how to sort of recalibrate in your brain, is that you don't want things to be equal anymore. Some notes are louder than others. pitches are not quite the same. You don't blow equally because the notes on the flute require different things. So that's like the biggest difference between the two instruments.
You became a flute professor at the University of Minnesota in 2001, 20 years. Does that feel like?
I know.
I mean, I got to be honest, you don't look like you could have been doing that for 20 years.
Well, I got the job when I was young, really young. And actually, what happened was that I was living in New York and I was freelancing and I was teaching. I'd been out of Juilliard for a while. And there was a one-year position here at the University of Minnesota. And at the same time I got that one-year position, I actually got a Fulbright to go to Holland to study Baroque flute. And I had to choose. And I don't have a doctorate. And all of my friends said, this is your chance to get into the university system and have a teaching experience, and you don't have this doctorate. So go do that, and you can do your Fulbright later. And then while I was here, it became a tenure-track position. And so I reapplied for the tenure-track position, and I got that. And then during those 6 years, I was able to take a year off and I reapplied for my Fulbright. And I went and I did get to study Baroque flute for a year. So I always kind of joke that, you know, this job started as a one-year position. And now this is my 20th year. It feels a little bit like Gilligan's Island. It was starting out as a three-hour tour. And then it became this main part of my career.
What was most memorable about that experience of studying Baroque flute? And you did that at The Hague.
That was an amazing experience. Well, I'll tell you the first thing that struck me, which was that I went there in the summer of 2005, and it was in August, they have always the Utrecht Early Music Festival. The first concert I went to was a Sunday afternoon concert of the complete musical offering of Bach. And there were about 1,500 people in the audience to listen to this piece for flute, violin, cello, and harpsichord. And about half of those people had scores. And I thought, okay, I'm in a different world here. You know, we don't, you would never get 1,500 people in the U.S. to go listen to this piece by Bach, you know, this little, small, complicated chamber music piece. So that was like the first thing that said to me, okay, I'm in just like on a different planet right now. But then what was great about being at that school was that there were so many people who just wanted to play early music. There were, you know, when I was there, there were something like 15 students studying the viola da gamba, which is totally, I mean, you don't have, I don't think there are 15 people playing the viola da gamba, you know, in the U.S. Well, there probably are. But I mean, it's just like all in one school to have so many people, and all they wanted to do was that. So just to be totally immersed in that language and in that world for that year was probably the biggest memory and impact that I had from that.
You're also a certified teacher in the Alexander technique. Can you talk about what that means and how that maybe helps you as a performer?
Basically, it's sort of a mindfulness practice. And it's something that a lot of musicians and actors do. And I was just talking about this last night with friends at dinner. My wife is from Missoula, Montana. And we were having dinner with somebody else who's here and visiting from Missoula. And they were talking about the paper mill that used to be in Missoula. And they said, oh, yes, you would smell that paper mill. But then eventually you became so used to it, you didn't think about it anymore. And the Alexander technique is a little bit like that. We all have habits that we become so used to that we don't think about them anymore. And it's something that brings those habits up into our sort of consciousness. And then it gives you a framework for getting rid of habits that we all, especially as musicians, where we maybe are too tight or we have over-practiced, you know, because we're trying to get something really, you know, perfected. And it just shows you how to let your body do its most natural way to perform something. And I would say that that has had a big effect on how I like to play the flute, especially the Baroque flute, because the Baroque flute, it very much responds to the effort that you put into it. And you have to really learn how to not push it at all. Like a modern flute, you can sort of get away with muscling it a little bit, with being strong. And the earlier flutes just say, oh no, you have to figure out how to make your air very free, but without overemphasizing anything. So that's a little bit how Alexander has had an effect on my playing.
Your new recording is your fourth release, and it's all about celebrating flute music for the court of Louis XIV. Why did you want to make this recording?
If you play the Baroque flute, or even if you play the modern flute, the music from this time is sort of our golden age. In fact, as I was saying earlier, I grew up on Jean-Pierre Rampal recordings, and some of the recordings that I have that Rampal made in the 1960s, it's actually some of the similar, not these pieces, but similar era pieces that he played, because it just sounds so great on the flute. And the flute at that time was a new and fashionable instrument. It's hard to believe because we think of the flute as everywhere, but the flute that we sort of know as the early Baroque flute, it was just becoming very popular at that time, which meant that all of the most famous and popular composers wanted to write for it. And people like Louis XIV wanted to have the latest fashion at their court. So there's great music for that instrument. I wanted to play this repertoire for two reasons. One, I love it. I have this awesome replica of an early French flute. And then I wanted to play with my colleague on this recording, Bart Kuyken, because he's totally a master at playing this repertoire. And Bart's exactly 20 years older than I am. And so I sort of grew up listening to his recordings, and I heard him playing French music. Oh, well, he's recorded everything on the Baroque flute. And when we became friends and we started to play together, we played a bunch of programs of French music. And I said, Bart, can we make a CD of this stuff? And he said, yeah, let's make a CD. And I just think that the two Baroque flutes, especially these, he has the same model copy that I have, and we have them both by the same maker. And it's just like that they blend so well together. And you don't have to do anything. We just both played, and the instruments and the way we thought about the music, it just blended so well together. So that's why I wanted to do this repertoire with the two flutes.
The program follows the birth of the flute and its first 40 years. And I'm wondering, what did you discover as you were putting this recording together with this repertoire that maybe was surprising to you?
What I discovered in this repertoire was the great variety of styles, of feeling, all within sort of like a common language. So you would have music that's very dancey. Music that's very spoken. Literally, we have a couple of songs on here where the flute, at the very beginning, in the early part of the 18th century, the flute might play the melody of a song and then the singer would sing it. And the flutist's ideal would be to sort of inflect the song so you could hear the words. And these flutes are really great about doing that. So I would say that those are the kinds of things that I discovered about this repertoire, or about really inflecting a piece of music so it sounds like it's a spoken text, and how possible that is to do on one of these earlier flutes. And also just the wonderful variety of all of the different moods and characters and feelings of this repertoire. We sort of think of this music as a little bit, stilted and old-fashioned, and the reality is that these people were as passionate and feeling as we are today.
That's actually something that's very interesting about this repertoire, is it's supposed to be very controlled with very little emotion. And so when you say it's still passionate, I'm thinking, well, how can that be if you're supposed to sort of eliminate the emotion? Can you talk more about that?
Well, the emotion's not on the surface. There's no one yells at it. It's not like a passionate scene out of a soap opera where somebody, yells about how much they've been hurt. But here, it's deep. It's It's below the surface, but it's there. And then it never lasts for very long. You can never let that feeling that you had that you've been hurt or something last for very long. There's a great quote that's slightly later than this music, but I think it still describes the flutes especially, which is that somebody said about the flutes, early flutes in French opera, that the flutes moaned and groaned with the sounds of unrequited love. And I think that that's all over the place in this music. It's like there's a little bit of moaning, a little bit of groaning about something that you didn't quite get, but you can't really let on about it. But it's clear that emotionally you have been wronged.
One of the things you told me just a few minutes ago before we started talking is how you don't really speak French. And so I thought that was very interesting because I was asking you to help me with my French through some of these titles. Can you tell me a little bit more about you and your love of French music, but your lack of ability to actually speak it?
I mean, I can say a few words here and there. And I can get myself a cup of coffee when I'm in Paris, but I'm certainly not going to say any for you now. It's just, you know, you grow up loving French music. You then love other things about, you know, I used to have a great French flute. You just have all these things. And now, well, I'm thinking of two things. One, actually, the great Francois Couperin, of course, we play his pieces on this CD. He said, and I don't really agree with him anymore about this, but what he said, what is so difficult about French music for non-French players is that it is like our language. It doesn't sound like it looks. And actually, in preparing for this recording, especially for the songs, I took French lessons on with a French speaker on how to speak these songs and how to say them so I would get the right inflection and the right accent so that I could then carry that over into my playing. And so I used to feel guilty about not speaking French, but wanting to play French music until my wife got me this awesome French cookbook by one of my heroes, Melissa Clark, who does all the food videos for the New York Times. She's an awesome chef. And her most recent book is called Dinner in French. And in the beginning of it, she says that her whole style of cooking is based in French cuisine, but she herself doesn't speak a word of French. And I actually wrote to her and I said, I just love that you don't speak French, but your whole career is in French cuisine, because I don't really speak French either, but my favorite repertoire for the flute is also French.
Which makes it accessible to all of us then. Thank you for that. I want to talk about some of those songs. You've referred to these songs, and that actually is part of the development of the flute. Can you identify a couple of those pieces for us and just talk us through them a little bit?
Well, the first song, which is called The Triumph of Love, which is from the opera by Lully, is in fact the first piece of music from 1681 that actually says, four flutes. This is the first piece of music that said, oh, this should be played on the flute. So we thought, okay, we have to do that little piece. And I think when people hear that piece, they might recognize that theme because it's lasted throughout history. It's a pretty wonderful, short little song.
So the Lully is the earliest piece that we know of having been written for the flute. So that's super cool. Then the oldest piece, at least that's on this recording, is the Couperin.
Yeah,
Talk a little bit about this, because this also is a world premiere recording. No one's recorded this version of this piece. Is that right?
It is true. And I don't know why, because it works beautifully for two flutes. It's originally for two bass instruments, like two bass viols or two viola da gambas or something like that. And a lot of composers at this time, they would write a piece of music and they'd say, it's for this, but in case you don't have two of those, hey, do it on two treble instruments. Do it on this or this. And part of that was just because not everybody had two gambas, but there might be two flutes in the house. But it also, it would increase sales, because then you could sell your version to flute players and violinists and stuff like that. So this is a piece that we just, or Bart actually did a little transposing of it, where he wrote it out in flute clef, so it was just easier for us to read. It just works super nicely for the two flutes, so that's why we did this duet.
And we should mention that Bart is Barthold Kaiken, who's very well known in the world of Baroque music. How did the two of you become friends and collaborators?
Well, I played for him when I was a student in a master class. I was just beginning to play Baroque flute, and I went and played for him, and I actually played him a little French piece. And this is more than 20 years ago, and I confess I just didn't know anything about it. And he is a wonderful teacher and a great guy, and he very sweetly pointed out all the things I didn't know. So I said, okay, I better go practice, I better go study. And then I ended up with my Fulbright, where I said, okay, I'm going to really spend this year dedicated to studying this Baroque flute stuff and the performance practice and the style and the instrument. And so I went to Holland, where I actually, my official teacher when I was there was this guy named Wilbert Hazelzit, who's an awesome Baroque flutist, and he used to be in this group called Musica Antiqua Cologne, and he's an amazing musician, an amazing flutist, and I studied with him, and he was my official teacher, but I also would go, they had sort of an open-door policy in The Hague, and I would go take lessons and watch lessons with Bart, and I learned a lot from him in those lessons. And then after the end of my Fulbright, I was having lunch with Bart, and I said, hey, I'd love for you to come to the University of Minnesota the next time you're in the U.S. and just come as a guest and give a recital and and teach. And so he did that. And then from that, he came here almost every year or every other year. And then we started to play together. We started playing duets. And it turned out that he thought that maybe I had actually practiced and learned my stuff. And so when I said, hey, would you make this CD with me? He said, yes. And he's been extremely generous and supportive of my endeavor as a Baroque flutist and of me having this sort of split personality career. Because he started out as a modern flute player, and he played lots of contemporary music, which was what people were doing in his time, still are. And he, like in his earliest recordings as a Baroque flute player, you cannot tell, but he was equally busy as a modern flute player playing Schoenberg and stuff like that. And then he just got to the point where he's just said, okay, I'm only going to focus on this one thing. And so he dropped doing that modern flute and just went to Baroque. And he's been supportive of me saying, I need to do both in my life. And, can I still be a valid Baroque flute player if I still want to make vibrato and play contemporary music? He said, of course, So that's been a wonderful thing with my relationship with him.
There's another world premiere on this recording from Jacques Hotteterre. Is that how you say his name? Tell me about this piece and how it represents the progress of the flute.
So on this CD, there are mostly pieces for two flutes and harpsichord and gamba. And the Hotteterre that you just mentioned is a piece that Bart plays as a solo. And it's a beautiful song that Hotteterre wrote. And then what's really wonderful about it is that he writes then variations with ornaments, very heavily ornamented. And not only are those ornaments beautiful, but they give us a real insight into how somebody in the 18th century would have improvised over a song. So like that, if you take another song, you could say, oh, I could sort of lift and borrow these ideas that Hototerra wrote out himself. So that's what is so beautiful about that song, is that you get to hear this double where he writes out these very beautiful and expressive and sort of complicated ornaments.
Now, I know you're featured as a soloist as well. Can you talk about the piece where we hear you?
Well, let's see. I play my solo piece. It's a sonata by Michel de la Barre. And that's one of the earliest sonatas for flute. And that's for flute, gamba, and harpsichord. And I love this piece. What I really love about, well, I love the whole thing, but there's this chaconne, the second movement. Which is just a very friendly and happy sort of just walking through the meadow on a really gorgeous day with low humidity. Kind of day.
I love that piece. That is so beautiful. And this also represents a time when the flutist was starting to have that desire to be a virtuoso as a soloist, right? Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because Michel de la Barre was really one of the first great flute virtuosos and principal flute of the Paris Opera Orchestra. So talk a little bit more about that transition and the development of the instrument.
It's just that people did more and more of it. So it started out the flute playing these simple little songs as people were sort of learning, like, oh, what can the flute do? Oh, it can express this, it can express that, and mostly just sort of using it to imitate the human voice, of course. And then people came along, and they said, oh, wow, it turns out the flute could also do this kind of stuff, bigger, more virtuosic, expressive things. And so this piece, he really runs the flute through the gamut. I mean, it's got very technical passages with lots of fast articulation. It's funny because, like, it's very technically, it's a little bit challenging, but it's also very idiomatic. Because Michel de la Barre was a wonderful flutist, so he was going to write something that made him sound good.
Smart man.
Yes.
The recording closes out with the suite number 2 in G minor by Maran Murray. Why is this suite the right way to complete this journey?
Well, I think because Murray, he uses all of the great forms of French music. It is so French. It is so expressive, this piece. And it builds in such a wonderful way. Again, it also has this passacaglia at the end. So it's a repeating, it's like a chaconne. It's this repeating bass line that just builds and builds. And it really takes you on a long journey. And this whole piece is so beautiful and in the journey that it takes you on, that it sort of, it wraps up everything that we have started out on this whole CD, from the smaller songs, from the sonatas, from the duet. It just finishes out everything really beautifully.
A new recording called La Magnifique, featuring flutist Emmanuel Davis, and he's joined by his good friend Bartold Kaiken. It's flute music for the court of Louis XIV. Thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing new classical tracks. And if you're enjoying this podcast, you know what? The best thing that you can do for it is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. And since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, the Piano Puzzler Podcast, where every week host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio, and they play one of his brilliant musical mind games where Bruce takes a familiar tune and disguises it in the style of a classical composer, and then a contestant has to try to figure it out. If it sounds like fun to you, subscribe to The Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.